stomach.
Thank you very much. And he had crossed the Yabok River, and then he goes back all by himself late at night. And Chazal say, why did he go back? Why does it say, Vayivaser Yaakov Levado, he remained by himself? He was Chozer Al Pachim Ketanim. He went back to retrieve small, insignificant earthenware jars. Why did he go back late at night in a dangerous place to retrieve small earthenware jars? Chazal say, Tzadikim, Chavivin lahem mamonam yosher migufam. A tzaddik cares more about his money, his property, than even the safety of his body. Very, very difficult Gemara. Right? It almost plays into the old anti-Semitic idea, Jews are cheap, Jews care about money. What's going on? Yaakov goes back to retrieve some insignificant earthenware jars. But the emphasis is, Chazal are teaching us a very, very deep lesson here. And that is, to a tzaddik, every single resource that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him has a use. It is used for Avodas Hashem. There is no such thing as having more than you need. You might have more than you need in terms of what you're going to use yourself. But everything you have, Kri Tzedaka, Chesed, Avodas Hashem. So Yaakov Avinu says, if the Eibishter gave me 3 paper clips, then I need 3 paper clips. 2 would not be enough for my mission in this world. Now again, most of us are not on the Madrega where we understand this. So Yaakov Avinu goes back to the Pachim Ketanim, because if he wouldn't have needed the Pachim Ketanim for some spiritual reason, Hashem wouldn't have given it to him. And that is why when Esav describes his wealth, Esav uses the Lashon, Yeshli Rav, I have more than I need. Because when you live a life for physical gratification, yes, there is a point at which you have more than you need. How much do I need for my tivus? $1 billion? $1 million is not enough anymore. $1 billion? $2 billion? So yeah, I have more than I need. A tzaddik can never say, I have more than I need. A tzaddik cannot say, I have less than I need. Whatever the Eibishter gave me is exactly what I need. If I have less, I am Sameach B'chelko. If I have more, Hashem gave it to me for a purpose. And that is why Yaakov Avinu was Chazer Al Pachim Ketanim. This is why the Torah gives us a commandment of Bal Tashchis, not destroying things. Because any resource HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us has to have some positive purpose that we put it to. So that is one explanation of why he was Chozer Al Pachim Ketanim. But there's another explanation that the Mekubalim say. Very beautiful explanation. Perhaps you heard this. And that is, the word Pachim Ketanim, small jars, is the same Lashon Chazal used for the miracle of Chanukah when they found a Pach Shemen, a jar of oil that was not contaminated, that was sealed with the chosam of the Kohen Gadol. According to these Mekubalim, which again it has a source in some Midrashim, when Noach, right, Noach lived during the flood, the whole world was destroyed. And he sends out a dove. First he sends out the raven, and the raven didn't find anything. He sends out the dove, and the dove comes back with an olive leaf in its mouth. And you have to understand, even on an emotional level, what a great simcha this was. Because the world was destroyed, there was nothing left. And this was the beginning, the first sign of rejuvenation, the first sign of growth, was the olive leaf that the dove brought back. Trees are growing again. And the olive, of course, is deeply symbolic, because the olive creates olive oil, and the olive oil represents light, and light also represents Torah and Kedushin. And it is said that on that olive leaf, there was actually an olive that was attached. And Noach squeezed the oil out of that first olive. And just know the way people, if you have a business, right, you put into a picture frame sometimes the first dollar that you made, or the first 10 shekel, maybe 20 shekel piece that you made, or when people get dollars from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, if you're Chabad, they keep the dollar, etc., and the like. So Noach kept that first oil, because that first oil is so symbolic. It means that never give up hope, that even when a whole world is destroyed, Hashem will recreate Hashem will bring back oil. And it is said that that jar was lovingly passed down from Noach to Shem, and eventually from Shem to Avram Avinu, and Avram to Yitzchak, and Yitzchak to Yaakov. And that was the pach that for some reason he had left behind. And now we understand why he had to go back and get it. And that was the pach that actually survived all the way to the Hanukkah story, from which the Chashmonaim lit the menorah that burnt 8 days. So now we understand it was not simply a question that Yaakov cared about his pachim ketanim, but that particular pachim ketanim he certainly cared about. Of course, it's a little schwer because pach is one. I mean, they only found one pach. Why does it pachim ketanim plural? That I don't have an answer for. But the Medrash does connect it to the miracle of Chanukah. Okay. But be it as it may, as Yaakov goes back to retrieve the Pachim Ketanim, all of a sudden he is accosted by a man, quotation mark, who is wrestling him the entire night. And in the morning, the man smites Yaakov's thigh and he's limping. And Yaakov asks the person for a bracha. The person gives him a bracha. And then he asks the person's name, and the person says, Lama zeh tishal l'shmi, don't ask my name. So, very, very mysterious scene, and the Torah does not tell us at all who that man is. But Chazal teach us that this man is really an angel in the guise of a man, and this man, or this angel, is the guardian angel of Esav, the Sarai shel Esav. That before Yaakov confronts the physical Esav, he must confront the spiritual force of Esav. And what is the overall message, just b'derech pshat? So the Sefer HaChinuch says, very, very simple and beautiful explanation as to what it represents generally. And he says that Maisa Avay Simen Labanim, whatever happens to our forefathers, is a sign what will happen to their children. Night is a remez of Golus. Hashem is telling Yaakov, the Jewish people will have a long, dark period of exile. They will be in darkness. There will be Hester Panim. And in that long period of exile, there will be people and nations that will try to destroy you, that will hurt you, that will wrestle with you. When people are wrestling, perhaps you have sons who wrestle, or whatever it would be, sometimes one is on top and sometimes the other is on top. There are going to be times in which you will be pinned to the ground helplessly, in which you will be beaten, in which you will be hurt, in which you will be assaulted. And this gullus is not going to be easy. There'll be so much suffering. But at the end of that night, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Yaakov, there will be the breaking of the dawn. And in the dawn there will be redemption. And not only will you survive, but the very nations that tried to destroy you through that long night will bless you, will acknowledge that Am Yisrael was a source of goodness and a source of Kedusha, will worship Hashem, as the Navi tells us. All the nations of the world will come to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, they're not going to become Jewish, because in point of fact, the Gemara says that people cannot convert once Mashiach comes. The gates of conversion are closed. You've got to join the Jewish people when things are bad for the Jewish people. You can't join the Jewish people when everything is great. That's called a fair-weather friend. So they're not going to become Yidden, per se. Ein makabalim geirim limos HaMashiach. But they will acknowledge Hashem. They will come to Yerushalayim. Right, ki beisi, the famous pasuk, ki beisi, beis tefila, yikarei, l'chol ha'amim. This will be the house of prayer for the whole world. So therefore, the message is, as the Navi Yeshayo said, and the Sefer HaChinuch explains, al tira avdi Yaakov. Don't be afraid. Don't give up hope. Hold on in the pains and the difficulties of Golus. Because it would end. It will end. It will end with Geula. It will end with Or. It will end with Bracha. It will end with reconciliation, even with the enemies that try to destroy us. And that's a great, great message of comfort. But at the same time, it's a bit sobering. Because when the Geula finally comes and we come out of Golus, we're not going to emerge unscathed. Yaakov did not emerge unscathed. When the dawn came, Yaakov is limping. When the Geula comes, we will have suffered tremendously, whether it's Holocaust, whether it's Crusades, whether it's the massacres that, B'Avonoseinu HaRabim, still occur to this very, very day. We will be limping, but we will be alive. And from that life will eventually come a refuah, just as Yaakov was cured and healed. Vayavo Yaakov Shalem, Ir Shechem. And Chazal say, Shalem is even begufa, meaning he was limping, but the Eibishter gave him a refuah for that as well. And of course, perhaps it's symbolic that Shechem to this very day is a place of Peronius, a place of tragedies. Yosef was sold in Shechem. And even today, Shechem is a hotbed of Islamic extremism, right? The kever of Yosef is in Shechem, and the kever gets destroyed and massacred and people get killed. But it's very significant that the Shleimus shall be in Shechem, v'yavu Yaakov shalem ir Shechem, that even the enemy that destroys us will give us a bracha. This is what the Sefer Achinuch says. So that's very significant. That, you know, kashrus generally, you know, why don't we eat chazer, etc., has all sorts of symbols for that. But one of the laws of kashrus is we don't eat the gid hanasheh, we don't eat the sciatic nerve. And because the sciatic nerve is a very, very long nerve with many branches, and it's located in the hindquarters where the thigh is, and it's very, very difficult to traber. It's very difficult to remove the gid hanasheh because it's so big and intertwined with fat and meat. So that is why it is customary, at least in Chutz Laaretz, that the whole hindquarter of kosher animals is not even prepared for kosher consumption. It is sold to non-Jewish slaughterhouses, which is why, if you're a cook, there are certain cuts of meat, sirloin and filet mignon and the like, which you normally cannot get as a kosher cut in Chutz Laaretz unless it's a fancy restaurant that does a special order, because that is where the gid hanasheh is located. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, in places where there's a shortage of meat, sometimes butchers will go to the great tircha of being menaker, but it's a very big chachma. To be menaker, the gid hanasheh, is an umnes. It is not a simple skill. So one should have kavod for one's butcher. Menaker is to remove the gid hanasheh, the sciatic nerve, and that's very difficult because it branches out and you have to do. So one should have kavod for a butcher. It actually is a skilled, profession. Halachically, there are skills, and physically, it takes a lot of skill. Okay, but be it as it may, although kashrus has its own symbols, gid hanasheh has a unique symbol. In other words, when I don't eat the gid hanasheh, the Sefer Achinuch says, I am reminded of Hashem's promise that after the darkness of Golus shall come a Geula. So it's a unique meaning within the laws of Kashrus generally of not eating the Gid HaNashem. So this is the Sefer Achinuch. And once again, one can understand as well the connection to the Pachim Ketanim, because Chanukah too is the notion that in the darkness of Golus there will be light. So Yaakov is connecting the Pachim Ketanim with that, with what Hashem shows him with the angel of Esav. But now the Chafetz Chaim makes two observations about this mysterious struggle. And that is, Chazal say the angel of Esav is not just the angel of Esav, but in a more generic sense it represents the Yetzer Hara. It represents the Satan. It represents the powers of impurity that try to destroy holiness from entering the world. It's not just Esav. Esav is symbolic of all of those things. So the Chafetz Chaim points out, why do we find that the angel of Esav only attacks Yaakov? Why don't we find, again, it wouldn't be Esav per se, why don't we find some negative angel attacking Avraham or Yitzchak? Why is this struggle, man-to-man struggle, why does that only occur with Yaakov Avinu? So the Chafetz Chaim's answer is that we know, Chazal teach us, Pirkei Avos, Al Shleisha Devarim Ha'olam Omed, the world stands on three pillars, Torah, the learning of Torah, Avoda, divine service, Gemilas Chasadim, acts of loving kindness. The world cannot survive without all three. You need all three. Torah, Avoda, Gemilas Chasadim.
But Chazal also teach us that each of the Avos exemplified in their own lives one of those pillars. And that's why Am Yisrael comes from the three Avos. Avraham Avinu represents the pillar of the world that is loving kindness. This was his primary avoda. Again, not to the exclusion of others. Avraham davened as well. But his primary emphasis on how he served HaKadosh Baruch Hu was through the kayach of the chesed and the love and the compassion that he showed everybody in the world. Yitzchak Avinu, who was the dedicated korban, is the epitome of avoda, of prayer, contemplation, meditation. Yetzer Yitzchak Lasuach Basada, korban. Yaakov, who spent 14 years of uninterrupted, even without sleep, or whatever that meant exactly, of learning Torah in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, represents the koach of limud HaTorah. Torah, avodah, so in reverse order actually, gemilas chasadim, avodah, Torah, represent the avos. Now in this way we see, well you can interpret it two ways, because it's pointed out that Avraham had a Yishmael, a pasolas, and Yitzchak had an Esav. And it's only Yaakov that is mitaso shalema, that all of his children are sanctified and are part of the Jewish nation. Now you can understand this in two ways. One way of understanding it is that Torah is greater than the other two, because from Chesed alone you get a Yishmael, from Avodah alone you get an Esav. It's only the Korach HaTorah that gives you mitaso shalema. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it might be a little different, and that is, you can't have an Am Yisrael till you have all three pillars. So Avram put in pillar one, Yitzchak put in pillar two, and it's not that Yaakov's pillar is better than Avram and Yitzchak's pillar. Rather, Yaakov put in pillar number three, and now you have three pillars, now Am Yisrael can come into existence. But the Chafetz Chaim goes with the first Mahalach about the greatness of Torah. Because here's what the Chafetz Chaim says. The Sarei Shel Esav wants to destroy holiness in the world. The Sarei Shel Esav wants to bring sin, wants to bring Tumah, wants to prevent Yaakov Avinu from creating the Am Hashem. But here is the way the Yetzer Hara works. The Yetzer Hara is perfectly happy to let Jews do good things, as long as the Yetzer Hara is confident it's not going to last, and it's going to be ephemeral, transient, and temporary. The Yetzer Hara is a wise investor. He doesn't waste battles. Let him do good! If after one generation, two generations, or a few years, it'll disappear. But when the good is going to have a kiyum, a fulfillment, and a duration, that the Yetzer Hara wants to stop. So says the Chafetz Chaim the following. A Yiddishkeit that is primarily based on chesed without Torah. Chesed is still a wonderful thing, but there's not going to be intergenerational continuity. Eventually the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren are going to leave it because they don't have a basis, they don't have a foundation to continue. A Yiddishkeit that's based on avodah, same thing. So the Yetzer Hara says, let Avram do his chesed, because after a few generations, there won't be any Jews. Let Yitzchak do his avodah. Same thing. It is only when there's a Korach HaTorah that there will be intergenerational continuity. Now, the truth of the matter is, those of you that are familiar with the history of Torah Judaism in the United States know how exact this description is. There have been Jews in America since 1650. They were there from even before the United States. But the big, big waves of immigration occurred in the 19th century. First, German Jews, who were largely assimilated, and then Polish and Russian Jews, who were very poor and less assimilated, more observant, although not everybody was from, etc. And many of them were religious, particularly of the second wave, and the like, the Ellis Island, you know, people, and the like. But the first thing Jews did, beikar, they put their kochos, it was creating what you might call chesed institutions, fraternal lodges, burial societies, the famous Jewish hospitals like Maimonides, Mount Sinai in New York. So Jews would have a place if they were sick, they would have a hospital to go to if they couldn't afford it. So the emphasis was on chesed, and that was necessary. I mean, some people were so poor, they needed places where they could get food and lodging and the like. And then the next move was magnificent, magnificent synagogues. Many of you might remember, if you grew up in some urban areas in the United States, the old synagogues with magnificent stained glass windows. They don't build synagogues like this anymore.
And we have stained glass windows, too.
Okay, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Well, in Eretz Yisrael, that's good. But in Chutz La'aretz, they don't do it anymore. And the reason is because we realize now that a synagogue in Chutz La'aretz typically lasts no more than 30 or 40 years. Neighborhoods change. I can still show you the magnificent synagogues in Harlem, in downtown Baltimore, with the Aseres HaDibros carved in stone and with Hebrew on the stained glass windows. But Rachmana Litzlan, almost all of them are churches now. And what is worse is that the children of these Jews who built magnificent synagogues and the children of these Jews who founded Mount Sinai Hospital and Maimonides, or if not the children, the grandchildren, are by and large certainly not religious Jews. And in many cases are not Jews at all through intermarriage and through assimilation. Yes, that generation laid a foundation based on chesed and laid a foundation based on avoda. But without Torah, the edifice collapses after a few generations. Now, there were some notable exceptions. There were people. I mean, this is called the lost generation. Basically, the Jewish children who grew up between World War I and World War II, the 1920s, 1930s, and a little earlier than the 1920s, by and large, almost none of them remained observant, even though their parents may have been observant. Almost all of them left. And there were actually great rabbanim. There were rabbanim who really were of gedolim status. And they have children. I don't even mention names because of Lashon Hara, but they have children who totally left Yiddishkeit, absolutely. There were some exceptions. There were some heroes who remained firm even without yeshivos, even without Torah study, like Irving Bunim, people who just founded Young Israel and the like. But they were mi'uta de mi'uta de mi'uta. The growth of Yiddishkeit in the United States, and there's still a lot to be done, for sure, really came only in the aftermath of World War II, primarily, when people like Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Moshe Feinstein, they created yeshivos, kolalim, and maybe most important, day schools, Torah Amsora, or Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz, throughout the United States, where every community that has more than 5,000 Jews has an Orthodox day school. This is a remarkable, remarkable achievement, and the like. And that is when Yiddishkeit remained, because the Chafetz Chaim says, when there is Torah, there is intergenerational continuity. There is what I can give my children. They understand what Yiddishkeit is about. They understand mitzvahs. They understand what Hashem wants us to do in the world. And that is why the Chafetz Chaim says, the Sarai shel Esav wanted to destroy Yaakov. Let the Jews do chesed. It's not going to last. Let the Jews do avoda even. It's not going to last. But Torah is nitzchias, eternity. When there's eternity of Kedusha, the angel of Esav is going to attack. But Baruch Hashem, the angel of Esav could not defeat Yaakov. The angel of Esav could not win. Because no matter how difficult the night of the Golus, there will be Jews who will never give up Torah. They will learn Torah in poverty. They will learn Torah in suffering. They will learn Torah even if they have to die al Kiddush Hashem, as Rabbi Akiva, whose flesh was flailed with iron combs. But this is the Chafetz Chaim's second observation. The Sarah Shel Esav did have a partial victory. He could not destroy Yaakov. He could not destroy the power of Torah, but he dislocated the thigh. What is the thigh? The Zohar says, just as
the thigh supports the body. I stand up. The thigh supports the body. So the thigh of Yaakov represents the economic support of Torah. The angel of Esav could not destroy Torah, but the angel of Esav had a partial victory that the financial support of Torah will always be precarious and limping. Ad kidei kach, that the Chafetz Chaim says, any yeshiva or mosad that does not have financial problems, one must be masupak, whether it's authentically a Torah institution, because the curse of Esav was that Torah is going to be limping. And again, if you think about this, there is so much mishugas in the world in which there seems to be unlimited money for entertainments, whatever it would be, sports. And again, I'm not begrudging soccer players. I mean, football players, they have a role to play in the world as well. And, you know, I don't mean to begrudge. But if you consider the fact that these are people that can get millions, $30 million, $40 million a year. And then you have a Rebbe, struggles, can't put bread on the table. How could that be? How could that be? How could it be? Good, pay soccer players. Again, I'm not begrudging. But some people get, you know, $40 million a year for kicking around a ball. And a person teaches Torah, can't put bread, or, you know, or maybe puts bread, but, you know, can't have, you know, chicken except once a week, and whatever it would be. Hayitachin? So the Chafetz Chaim says, this was Esav's victory, Taka. Esav's victory is that the Torah is going to have to suffer in this world. Ah, so you might say, Akasha, ah, so next time a yeshiva asks me for money, I say, you're supposed to be poor, what do you want? Chas v'shalom, I give you money. I am contravening the gezeirah. Well, you know, in the 19th century, when physicians developed anesthesia for childbirth, there were Christian theologians, all of whom were men, who said, women are not allowed to take anesthesia for childbirth, because Hashem cursed Chava. Be'etzav tel vibanim, you will give birth with suffering. Who are we to alleviate a woman's suffering during labor? And therefore, there were some Christian leaders who said, women cannot take anesthesia. What do we say? What do Yidden say? Now, again, I'm not suggesting, you know, the issue of natural childbirth, that's a medical issue and the like. But in terms of halacha, it's perfectly okay to take painkillers for the following reason. A curse is not a mitzvah. Hashem did not command Chava. We command you to suffer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I am creating a teva. The teva of labor is, it is painful. But we are given reshus to try to make the teva a little easier. Just like a person has sickness, you can take painkillers. A person has pains of labor, you could take anesthesia or whatever would be helpful. Because a curse is the natural propensity of the nature that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. But we are permitted to alleviate that. And sometimes we are commanded to. So the same thing. Hashem did not command that most of Torah be poor. Hashem said, this is the Teva, Shalolam. But we are mechuyev in terms of tzedakah to try to be machzik Torah in whatever way that we can. Yes, in a way we're told it's going to be a losing battle in the sense that there's always going to be financial problems. But we are still mechuyev to do our hishtadlus. Just like the Torah says, we must give tzedakah, even though Hashem said there will always be poor people. It's pasuk in Re'eh. Ephes, right? There will always be lo yechtal evyon mikerev haaretz. Actually, one pasuk says, "Lo yia evyon desli mosa mashiach." In this world, no matter how much tzedakah we give, there are going to be poor people. But that doesn't mean we don't do what we can to make their lives better. And Achzakas Torah is very much the same. Right? So those are the two observations of the Chafetz Chaim. Number one, why does the Sarah Shalesev attack Yaakov? And number two, what is the significance of the dislocated thigh? But now I want to take this a little further. Yaakov asks the angel his name. at the morning, at the break of dawn, the angel says, "Let me go." And Rashi says, because this is my time to praise Hashem, and angels are only given like one time in, you know, a million years, and this is my time, I have to go now. And Yaakov says, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And the angel blesses Yaakov with a name change, and I'll talk about that as well. But then Yaakov's final question is, "What is your name?" And the angel says, "Lamaza Tishalishmi. Why are you asking my name?" And that was the end of that conversation. Rashi explains, Rashi gives a pshat, that the angel says, "I don't have a fixed name, because my name depends on my job, on my responsibility. And every day I have new jobs, new responsibilities, so my name changes. I don't have a definite name, because my name is Taloi on my tafkid, on my role and on my mission." So according to Rashi's explanation, the angel is basically saying, "I don't have a definite name," meaning, you're asking me my definite name, I don't have a definite name. But Rav Shradran, the great Maggid of Yerushalayim, brings a pshat in the name of his Rebbe, Rav Yehuda Lev Chasman, who was a great, great Bal Musar, a great Talmud Chacham, who says that the angel is actually answering Yaakov's question. Yaakov asked the question, "What is your name?" The angel's answer is, "My name is, quotation mark, don't ask my name." That is my name. My name is, don't ask my name. What type of name is that? You may remember, perhaps, or if you're older, or maybe your parents would remember, a very famous Abbott and Costello routine about who's on first, in which I ask you, who's on first base, who's on first, and the person's name is who. So you answer, who's on first? And you say, "Why are you repeating the question? Give me the answer. Who's on first?" And you say, "Who's on first?" Right? So here, "What is your name? Don't ask my name. I want to know your name. My name is, don't ask my name." Right? It's the same thing. So what type of name is it? Don't ask my name. So Rav Chasman gives the following mashal, very, very interesting mashal. There was a Polish peasant, illiterate, uneducated, who came to the big city, Warsaw, whatever it is, for the first time, to buy stuff at in a fair, at a market or whatever. And everything is new to him. He never saw tall buildings. He didn't see, you know, cars. He never had electricity. And he buys different things. He has some money on him. And he sees a flashlight. He didn't know what electricity is, so as far as he's concerned, wow, this is amazing. You can put fire in a metal tube and push a button and the fire comes out, and push a button, the fire goes in, and it doesn't get extinguished. So he buys a big flashlight, very excited. And then somebody tells him, "You know, if you give money and buy a ticket, you can go into this room, and you'll sit in the room for a while, and the room will look empty. And you will see people and animals materialize out of nowhere." He's describing a movie theater, but in other words, the room will be empty, and all of a sudden it will be filled with people and animals and buildings, like magic. So the person was really curious about this, so he bought a ticket. He sits in a dark room. He sees other people are sitting. He figures they want to see the magic as well. And all of a sudden, the room was empty except for the people sitting in the chairs. All of a sudden, animals, horses, cowboys, Indians, because in Poland, you know, American movies were very popular, whatever it would be, buildings. What's going on? Magic. A minute ago, the room was empty. And he remembers, "I walked by when I entered the room, there was a wall, and I walked by the wall. There were no doors, there were no windows, there were no secret entrances. How did these things get in?" Now, for some reason, he didn't distinguish between two-dimension and three-dimension. I don't know why, but okay. But to him, it was really real. So he wanted to go and check out the wall. Maybe there was some hidden door I didn't see. So he takes his big, super-powered flashlight, and he shines it on the wall. But what happens is, when you shine a bright light on the images of a motion picture on a wall in a dark room, the light causes the picture to... You can't see the picture anymore. So people were yelling at him, "Sit down, shut off your light, shut off your flashlight.
we can only see the motion picture when it's dark. Rav Chassman said, this is a mashal to Olam Hazeh. When you sit in the darkness, you don't think about life, you don't have the perception of Torah, you sit in the darkness. All sorts of things look real when in fact they're just an illusion. Like the movie looked real. We think how much money we make is important. The power we have, the control, the fame, the public acclaim, or even the grudges that we hold on to, the little fights and the slights and the insults to our dignity. They become so real to us. They become so meaningful to us. Because we're in the dark. And vice versa. When you're in the dark, that which is not real looks real. But the reality that's right next to you, you're not even going to see. For example, I might be sitting in a movie theater, putting aside the halachic issue of going to movies, that's not our issue here. And I think the movie is real, but there might be some diamonds right next to me. There might be $1 million I won't even notice. So when you sit in the dark, that which is really an illusion seems so real and powerful. And you don't even see the reality that's next to you. When you turn on the lights, two things happen. You realize that what you thought was so real and important really doesn't matter. And then you can see the reality that's right next to you. It's all a function of turning on the lights. Now, of course, in the mashal was the physical light. But in the nimshal, it's not the physical light, but it's thinking about what life is about. Trying to clear the mind and clear the spirit. Why am I here? Why did Hashem put me here? What is my role in life? What is important in life? Serving Hashem, doing mitzvos. Avas Yisrael, caring about my family. The truth is, even from a secular perspective, even if we don't even use the vocabulary of Torah and mitzvahs, which of course we should, how many people devote their lives, you know, to accumulation of money, to buying a big house, and they don't relate to their own children, they don't relate to their own spouse. And it's been well said, after 120 years, when a person is on their deathbed, and a person has regrets, all of us unfortunately have regrets. We didn't live a perfect life. Nobody is ever going to say, why didn't I spend more time in my business? Why didn't I go into the office on, well, in Israel you work on Sunday, but let's say America, why didn't I go to the office on Sunday? But a person is going to think, why wasn't I nicer to my children? Why didn't I spend more time with my wife or my husband? Why didn't I give more tzedakah? Why did I hold on to grudges so much and make walls of separation between me and other people, including people of my family? That's going to bother a person. It is going to bother a person. Nebuch, Baruch Hashem. Now we have time to fix it. Now we have time to fix it. There's a famous mashal, I'm going to segue back to the Yaakov in a moment, but there's a famous mashal of the Magid of Kelim, not to be confused with the Altar of Kelim. The Altar of Kelim was a city in Lithuania. The Altar of Kelim was the Talmud Muvik of Rav Yisrael Salanter. The Magid of Kelim was also a great, great Magid, but a different person. He lived around the same time. The Magid of Kelim was really one of the most famous Magidim in the 19th century. After the Dubner Magid, he might be number two. And the Magid of Kelim had a very dramatic way of speaking. So he was once invited to speak to a kehillah before Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre, right before the beginning of Yom Kippur. And he gave this mashal. He said, that this, you know, do you see the cemetery next to the shul, the old Beis HaKvaris? HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought a techiyas ha-mesim to give all the mesim in the cemetery 1/2 hour to fix whatever they didn't fix before they died. And there was a tremendous rash gadol as everybody came, and some people ran into shul and they took a gemara to get extra learning in.
and other people took it to Tehillim to pray to Hashem, and other people went to ask Mechila, and other people went to their wives and their children to patch things up. And every time they're running around like a chicken without a head, they're running around and they're looking at the clock. It's only 27 minutes left, 25 minutes left, 24 minutes left. And it gets a crescendo and a frenzy, as everybody knows this is the last opportunity they have to fix everything. And, you know, he was a much more dramatic speaker than I am, so people were really so emotional, so nisruggish. And then, there's only 10 minutes left, and then there's 5 minutes left. And he's describing how this tremendous pachad among the mason. And then it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, back to the grave, this is it. And people in the audience were sobbing, they were crying. And then he ended his speech with two sentences. And Rabbi Sai, what is so bad if Hashem gave us more than a half an hour to fix? Because the truth of the matter is, we're going to have that same ending, but Baruch Hashem, Hashem has given us more than a half an hour, and then he ended. And who says we have a half an hour? People who went to the Beis Knesset in Har Nof 2 Tuesdays ago, they didn't know. Baruch Hashem, they were great tzaddikim, so there was not a lot they had to be misaking. But they didn't know that they didn't have a half an hour. So this is the idea of turning on the lights. Turning on the lights, thinking about the gift of life and using it in a good, constructive way. Not to put things off. Carpe diem, the Latin phrase. Seize the day. Seize the moment. Look at the opportunity. So now let's go back to Yaakov. Remember, Shadron started with this idea, in the name of Rav Chassman, that when Yaakov asked the angel, what's your name? The angel's name is, don't ask my name. Rav Chassman is Masber, that Yaakov is asking a deeper question. A person or a malach's name is the identity of their spiritual power. You know this. The name we give our own children, the name we have, is really representative of the force in our neshama. Now, we don't understand, but if somebody is a Sara, or somebody is a Devora, then, of course, you're named after a grandmother or an aunt or whatever it would be, but ultimately it connects to Sara Imena, Devora Hanavia. And in fact, the Arizal says that the name that parents choose for their child, the son or the daughter, is a nevuah. You might think you're naming it because you like the name or the parsha, whatever it is. It's a nevuah from Hashem, identifying the spiritual koach. Ad kedei kach, that some people hold, although some people are cholek on this, that once the name is pronounced, even if it was a mistake, but if Hashem caused that name to be pronounced publicly as the name, that becomes name. I was once at a bris where the namer was a grandfather, and the namer did not like the name that his children had chosen for the baby. So he just changed it. Pikare Shmo Yisrael, instead of Shlomo, he did Yitzchak or whatever it would be after his father or something. So I still remember, I was at this bris, I still remember hearing a wail from the women's section. The mother was very, very upset. And the Rosh Hashiva had paskind there, May Hashem Yetzar Davar, if this was the public name. Now again, many people are cholik. They say, well, listen, it's a nevuah that the parents get. Now if the nevuah was not properly communicated, all right, so I'm not paskinding halacha l'maisa. There. In fact, I was at a bris the next week with the same Rosh Hashiva, and almost the same thing happened, and he paskined it could be changed. You know, so maybe the mother gave him grief the first time. I don't know what happened there. But that's a separate issue. But a name is your spiritual power. So when Yaakov asks the angel of Esav, what is your name? He's asking the angel of Esav, how do you have power over people? Because if you think about it, you're the Yetzer Hara. You're the Satan. How do you entice people to do sins? If you think about it, and this is not my madrega, so I am, you know, easier said than done. Doing averus just doesn't make sense. Forget about being a tzaddik. It doesn't make sense. Whatever benefit you get is so much outweighed by the cost. And whatever inconvenience a mitzvah might cause is so much outweighed, it doesn't make sense. If I gave you two glasses, and I told you, one is a glass of water, and one is a glass of poison, do you have to be a tzaddik? I'm a tzaddik, so I'm going to take the water. It's just simple, common sense. Why would I take the poison? And even if I tell you, well, you know, the poison has a delicious chocolate taste. But it's poison. There's something bad about that. But it tastes real good. And the water doesn't have a taste. I mean, good, a person might accidentally drink the chocolate, I understand. But if you're told ahead of time, this delicious chocolate drink is poison, who would take the, what sane person would take poison? You don't have to be a righteous person. So Yaakov is perplexed. How do you entice people to do this stuff? It makes no sense. It's chocolate-flavored poison. And the angel's answer is, my power over people is, nobody asks questions. Don't turn on the lights. Loma Zatishal, don't think about it. If you think about it, you'll never go down that road. But Baruch Hashem, so to speak, the angel of Esav says, people don't think. They look at the chocolate, and they don't think about the fact that it's poison. Because a moment's reflection, right? And therefore, Yaakov asks a good question. What is your power? The answer is, my power is, people don't turn on the lights. When they don't turn on the lights, they think that which is real doesn't exist, and that which is fake becomes real, and therefore the whole system of reality. You know, this is really what charata is. What is regret over? So regret over sin is when you realize, how could I have done that? How could I be that way? Person sometimes, you know, again, sometimes a person might lose their temper. Get angry, say harsh words to a child. You know the famous teaching of the Stipler, by the way. In a way, hurting a child is more chamor than hurting an adult, because a child is not capable halachically of giving mechila. A katan cannot be mochel. Only a gadol can be mochel. It's a famous story about the Stipler. It's a famous story. You probably have heard it before. Where the Stipler, once on Rosh Hashanah, he saw a young boy lugging a big, big machzor. Like those machzor for people who can't see. And the Stipler thought it was a Gemara. It was as big as a Gemara. So he told the boy, you should be davening now. You shouldn't be learning Gemara now. So the boy said, well, this is a machzor for my Zaidi. So the Stipler asked his forgiveness and said, could you please tell me when your bar mitzvah is? The boy was 9 years old. So the boy said, well, 4 years from now, Parshas Truma. Okay, let's flash forward 4 years. There's a bar mitzvah in Bnei Brak. It's around 3 miles from the Stipler's house. 3 miles. Stipler could barely walk 10 feet. In the middle of the bar mitzvah, an old man who was dragging his feet walks in. And it's the Gadol HaDor, the Stipler. Now, the family didn't know the Stipler. They didn't invite him to the bar mitzvah, and they wouldn't have invited him because how could they be matriachim to walk 3 miles on Shabbos? He's huffing and puffing. He's barely breathing. Or his breathing is very deep, you know. And he walks very slowly over to the boy. And everyone is staring, what's going on? He says something to the boy. The boy says yes, nods his head. The Stipler wishes him a mazel tov, gives him a kiss. And then turns around and starts the other three-hour walk back home for 3 miles. And everybody is wondering, why did the Stipler come? And what did he say to the child? And they asked the child, what is it? And the child said, well, 4 years ago, the Stipler said something that he thought he hurt my feelings, although it wasn't such a big deal. And the Stipler wanted to know when my bar mitzvah was so he could ask my mechila, because when I was a katan, I was not able to be mochel. So the Stipler remembered the date. He walked a total of 6 miles on Shabbos. How many hours did it take him? How hard that was to ask my mechila. And then he went home. So the point I'm making is, just this is just a digression, but the point basically is, we sometimes lose our tempers. This is human. But then we ask ourselves, when we are calmed down, why did I do that? Why? Now, don't be too hard on ourselves. We have to do tshuva. We have to go on. We can't allow ourselves to get overly depressed, because that's a big yetzer hara in itself. But the point is, at the moment of anger, nothing else mattered. At the moment of anger, that feeling of rage or whatever was so strong within us, it had to come out no matter what. Because when you're sitting in the darkness and you don't think, that which really isn't so real becomes so real. And the real seems to disappear. When you turn on the lights, things are different. Now the emes is this. The emes is, this is very relevant to the Hanukkah message. The Gemara tells us, the Medrash Rabbah tells us that the four exiles are merumas in the second pasuk of Chumash Bereishis. When the Torah says, Ha'aretz ha'isa, sayhu vavayhu v'choshech al p'nei tahom. The world was astonishingly empty, and it was confused, and there was darkness on the face of the depths. The Medrash tells us, the emptiness is Bavel, which destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and made the world empty. Bayu is Persia that created confusion with Haman's decree, Ha'ir Shushan Nevocha, confusion. Darkness is the gullus of Yavan that made the eyes of the Jewish people dark. And Tahaim, the depths, is the gullus of Esav that is such a long gullus, long. It's like dropping a coin down a well that never seems to end. It never hits bottom. Al Pnei Tahaim, thousands and thousands of years. And then the Medrash goes on and say, the Ruach Elokim Merachefes Al Pnei Amayim is the Mashiach, that's the Ruach Hashem that will come into the world. So the Maral is Masber, that the four exiles, and we're considered to be in the Golus of Edom, although Yishmael is a partner of Edom in this last stage, that Bavel destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, Persia wanted to destroy our bodies, physically, but Yavan did not want to destroy our bodies. Yavan was not like Hitler. Yavan was not anti-Semitic. In fact, you could actually say, in some ways, Antiochus was a very enlightened despot. He was willing to grant the Jews full political rights. He was not an anti-Semite at all, as long as they give up the Torah, as long as they give up Bris Milah and Rosh Chodesh and Kashrus and Shabbos. Antiochus was perfectly willing to have Jews live in his empire as long as they would assimilate and be like everybody else. Now, the Maral says, Golos Edom, which we're in, is not a unique Golos. Golos Edom is simply an intensification of the other three. Like Babylonia, Edom destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, the second one. Like Paras, we have Holocausts and the like, and the Maral says the nations want to destroy us physically. And like Yavan, there are aspects which cause for assimilation and intermarriage. Meaning to say, the way you have to look at Golos Edom is, sometimes Edom is like Bavel, sometimes it's like Paras, sometimes it's like Yavan. So if we were to describe, let's say, what is Golos Edom like in the United States, it is really the Yavan of Edom, assimilation and intermarriage. If we would describe what it's like, well, there are very few Jews, Baruch Hashem, in Syria, but that would be like the Paras, in other words, the physical threat. Eretz Yisrael is kind of in between. Eretz Yisrael, we actually get hit with both. We have both the Goyim that want to destroy us, and we have the assimilation, even, Gachman will say, even intermarriage, which is a surprisingly serious problem in Israel. You wouldn't even imagine it would exist. But I understand, I just saw an article there might be between 30 and 40,000 Jewish young women who are married to Arabs in Arab villages. Some of them were even religious. They were kidnapped. No, not kidnapped, but they were enticed. Not kidnapped, enticed. And in fact, to make things even worse, I don't want to disturb you too much, but that would actually mean that it's been posited, and some have some evidence for this, that some people who are terrorists might halakhically be Jewish, because they are the children of Jewish women and Arab parents. And they were raised Muslim, not knowing anything. And this is it. Again, this is a tragedy. But once again, we have the combination of Yavan and that. Now, the Maral says, why is Yavan described as darkness? Why is the Golus of Yavan Choshek? Because, in a way, Yavan is not a real Golus. We're in Eretz Yisrael. We even have a Beis HaMikdash. So why is it Choshek? Because when you're in the dark, you don't see or appreciate the wealth that you have. The Golus of Yavan was not a Golus that took us outside of the land of Israel. It was not a Golus that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But through not turning on the lights, we were Machshev Hellenism and those values more than our own treasure. And we see from the Sorosh Shel Esav that the Yetzer Hara has power over us when we live in darkness. And therefore, the miracle of Hanukkah is the light of Kedusha that dispels that darkness. So may it be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will that we be zochet to kindle the light in our heart, in our soul. And of course, the very word Hanukkah, some say it's Chanu Chafei, they rested on the 25th. But the real meaning of Hanukkah, the real translation of Hanukkah, is dedication. And it represents the fact that for 3 years, the Yevanim controlled the Beis HaMikdash. They desecrated it. They put in Avodah Zarah. They sacrificed pigs to statues. They put in prostitution in the Beis HaMikdash. For 3 years, obviously we weren't able to serve Hashem there, but for 3 years they desecrated, contaminated it in all ways. And after 3 years, we regained that Beis HaMikdash. And we found that oil. And we dedicated the Beis HaMikdash for 8 days. In fact, you know, there's a famous Hanukkah question. If the miracle of the oil is that it burned for 7 days, seven extra days, because there was enough for 1 day, so why is Hanukkah only 7 days? Why is Hanukkah 8 days? It should only be 7 days, because the first day was not a miracle. This is a famous question. This is the question of the Beis Yosef. There are at least 500 answers to this question, because I've seen Sfarim that give 500 answers. But if you want a simple answer, that's al pi pshat. It's not so dramatic, but it's a simple pshat answer. And that is, the original reason why Hanukkah was 8 days was not because of the miracle of the oil. The reason why Hanukkah was 8 days is the ceremony of dedicating the Beis HaMikdash is always 8 days. When Moshe dedicated the Mishkan, there were 7 days of preparation plus the 8th day. So the Pashtus, Rav Akiva says, the Pashtus is that the holiday of Hanukkah is a celebration of the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash after its desecration. So the miracle of the oil may have been 7 days, 7 extra days, but the Chanukas HaBayis was 8 days. Again, that's a less dramatic answer, but that is an answer al pi pshat. But here is the thing. We say, Bilvavi Mishkan Evnes. I must build a Mishkan, a temple to Hashem, in my heart and in my soul. The Sfarim HaKadoshim tell us that just as Hanukkah was a commemoration of the Beis HaMikdash, Hanukkah can be the dedication of Hashem's presence in our heart and in our soul. It is a dedication of our own Beis HaMikdash. The light being Doche the Choshech of the darkness of Yavan. So may HaKadosh Baruch Hu give all of us the ability to light that candle within our hearts, within our souls. Bilvavi Mishkan Evnech, may all of us build a Mishkan for the Shekhinah in the way we live our lives. So good Chanukah for everybody.